This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is Bill Nauman reading from Civil Engineering, the magazine of the American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE, and from Civil Engineering Source, ASCE's News and Information website. Today we'll start with a piece from the source. From the field, fiber-reinforced concrete cuts time cost on a light rail project. It's a piece by Barzin Mobisher, PhD, PE, is dated April 12, 2024. Looking to reduce project costs on a critical light rail expansion project, Valley Metro, the regional public transit agency servicing the Phoenix metropolitan area, adopted dozens of value engineering approaches. Among them was the use of fiber-reinforced concrete, or FRC, instead of concrete reinforced with traditional steel bars, or rebar, for the track slabs. Use of FRC significantly reduced the required slab thickness and resulted in a much less labor-intensive construction process, decreasing construction time and costs, and increasing project sustainability. Cost savings needed. Valley Metro needed to realize significant savings during the development of its Northwest Extension Phase 2 project. The 1.6-mile-long extension opened for revenue service on January 27th, adding to the Valley Metro's existing 28-mile-long light rail system. The estimated costs for the extension project increased significantly during planning, prompting the value engineering process. Cost reductions for materials, labor, traffic control, and construction time were evaluated. The value engineering approach resulted in 75 options for consideration, of which 60 were accepted, including the substitution of FRC for concrete reinforced with rebar. Ultimately, the many changes realized $60 million in total savings, representing 23% of the project's construction cost. Validating FRC. The Structural Mechanics and Infrastructure Materials Laboratory at Arizona State University explored alternative design solutions for the reinforced concrete track slab. The goal was to develop a design process using FRC incorporating steel or polymeric fibers, obviating the need for traditional rebar. Along with reducing slab thickness, this approach would decrease the labor involved in welding the rebar and mitigating potential corrosion caused by stray currents that result from the electromagnetic nature of the current flow in the track's third rail. Validation tests were conducted on mock-up specimens of the two types of slabs, one using the original dimensions and with reinforced concrete, and another using FRC with steel fibers. Flexural tests were conducted on full sections to evaluate the performance of fibers in the track slabs, while fatigue testing was used to simulate the entire lifespan under service load conditions. The objective of these analyses was to yield valuable insights into the viability and long-term performance of the FRC system and compare FRC tracks with conventional tracks. Flexural testing. Rectangular, full-scale mock-up specimens were created for the testing. One version had conventional rebar reinforcement and was 8 feet long, 3 feet wide, and 14.5 inches deep. The other version had plain FRC and similar dimensions except for depth, which was reduced by about 17% to 12 inches as no rebar cover was required. The fiber dosage was selected based on initial design criteria for the flexural load capacity that would carry a maximum service load of 22.5 kips using a safety factor of 2. The 11.25 kips load mark was specified as the maximum service load an individual track slab would experience during its lifetime. For the direct flexural testing, three full-scale specimens representing the control reinforced concrete and two different steel fibers were used. The FRC specimens differed mainly in terms of their steel fiber dosages. One contained 2-inch-long steel fiber at a dosage of 60 pounds per cubic yard, while the other contained a fiber at a lower dosage. And the FRC specimen having the lower fiber dosage was eventually would be disqualified after failing fatigue testing, as noted below. The three full-scale specimens were situated on a 12-foot-long, simply supported span and subjected to a three-point bending configuration under a monotonically increasing load up to 56 kips. The load point was positioned at the center of the specimen and directly applied to the steel rail. The experiment assumed that the ground support for the slab had been lost and that the slab was acting as in a flexural mode with the resistance offered by the concrete. A direct comparison of the bending moment capacity between the two design types was possible. The specimens were instrumented with four linear variable differential transformers to measure the centerline deflection. Strains on the surfaces and the rebar were measured using strain gauges and the technique known as digital image correlation, which measures strain or crack openings by capturing images from the surface during the testing and using photogrammetry to measure incremental deformation between any two stages of loading. Static tests were conducted by loading the specimen until reaching the maximum capacity of 50 kips and recording the load versus deflection and strains. Deflection was determined by averaging the measurements of four LVDTs. The reinforced concrete specimen exhibited initial cracking at approximately 14 kips, beyond which the tension load was predominantly carried by the rebar. This transition resulted in a substantial increase in flexural stiffness, culminating in a maximum load at 48 kips at a deflection of 0.9 inches. In contrast, the FRC specimen having the fiber dosage of 60 pounds per cubic yard displayed a primary crack initiation at around 22.5 kips, followed by a gradual recovery in post-crack stiffness and an increase in loading capacity. These observations indicate a higher level of ductility of the material. The reinforced concrete specimen had a 76% higher stiffness in the elastic phase compared to the FRC specimen, primarily due to its larger depth. Consequently, the reinforced concrete specimen exhibited a lower cracking load because there were no fibers to suppress the propagation of microcracks, and the major cracks needed to form and open to activate the reinforcement to carry the load. However, following the initiation of the first flexural crack, the rebar effectively recovered the stiffness of the control specimen and significantly controlled the deflection, surpassing the behavior of the FRC specimen, which had a more ductile response. At a deformation of 0.1 inches in a span of more than 7 feet, the load capacity of the section is still more than three times the service load. When the elastic steel rail and FRC slab base were combined, they functioned as a composite beam. The combination yielded a hardening effect, with the steel rail still performing as an elastic beam following the initial cracking, evident with a peak load measurement of 39 kips at a deflection of 0.35 inches. It is noteworthy that the reinforced concrete in the FRC specimen types surpassed the required service load capacity of 11.25 kips, with a safety factor exceeding 2. Fatigue loading testing. A separate set of mock-up slabs of the same size were tested by means of cyclic fatigue loading conducted by full-scale loading and unloading cycles at a frequency of 4 Hz. This approach simulated 45 years of service life, the equivalent of a train passing every 6 minutes, day and night. To validate further use of the FRC track slabs, the load was almost twice the rated load of the axle of the train that would use the slabs. For the fatigue testing, the specimens were initially subjected to a load of 21 kips to initiate cracking, before undergoing another round of testing that involved loading and unloading 2 million times within a range of up to 17 kips. During the testing, the loading and unloading stiffness of the slab was measured every 50,000 cycles and used as a measure of degradation. The reinforced concrete test was terminated after 500,000 cycles due to a significant loss of stiffness. Of the two FRC sections, the one with a 2-inch long steel fiber used at 60 pounds per cubic yard met the required number of fatigue cycles. At the end of the 2 million cycle test, the cyclic loading had degraded the slab stiffness by 6%. By contrast, the FRC section with a lower fiber dosage failed at 70,000 cycles. The comprehensive full-scale flexural and fatigue test demonstrated that using FRC and track slabs results in adequate strength and fatigue life performance, offering a viable alternative to conventional designs. Test results indicated that using steel fibers with a dosage of 60 pounds per cubic yard significantly improved ductility and met the 45-year service life of 2 million fatigue cycles. Significant savings. The FRC design offers enhanced constructability due to its simplified process. The fibers are batched and directly added to the concrete mixer at the plant. The resulting mixture is poured into the formwork, which requires minimal setup, making the overall construction process more straightforward and efficient. Under the original reinforced concrete design approach, constructing a 16-foot wide by 1 mile long track slab would require 184,000 pounds of number 4 rebar and 298,000 pounds of number 5 rebar. By comparison, the FRC design approach only required 203,000 pounds for the same dimensions. The decrease in steel use enhanced the sustainability of the project by reducing its carbon footprint. All told, use of FRC cut construction time on the project nearly in half, from the 231 days per mile of track required by the conventional design to 121 days per mile of track. This dramatic reduction in construction time resulted primarily from eliminating the labor-intensive process of forming and placing rebar and placing concrete on a continuous slab containing rebar cages. At the same time, this design approach minimized traffic disruptions and reduced the need for road closures and traffic control devices during construction. Cost savings on the project were even more dramatic. Whereas the reinforced concrete approach had an estimated per mile cost of $17.5 million, the FRC design approach cost $5.3 million per mile, a reduction of nearly 70%. Barzin Mobisher, PhD and PE, is a professor at the School of Sustainable Engineering and the Built Environment at Arizona State University. Next up is another piece from the source. Policy briefing. Senate passes bill to mitigate danger of hard rock mine sites. A piece by Jay Landers, dated April 18, 2024. The U.S. Senate has passed bipartisan legislation aiming to improve the federal response to threats associated with abandoned hard rock mining sites. If left unaddressed, these sites can pose threats to physical safety and contribute significantly to environmental contamination, particularly in the American West, where they are most prevalent. The full extent of abandoned hard rock mining sites in the U.S. is unknown, though previous estimates have indicated that such sites probably number in the hundreds of thousands. For example, a March 2020 report from the U.S. Government Accountability Office found that four federal agencies had identified at least 140,000 abandoned hard rock mine features on land under their jurisdictions. The same report noted that the agencies also estimated that another 390,000 abandoned hard rock mine features could exist on federal lands but are not yet included in their databases. Making a List. Introduced on February 29th by Senators Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, and Cynthia Loomis, Republican of Wyoming, the Legacy Mine Cleanup Act, S-3858, would codify within the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency an office that Donald Trump's administration created more than 3 years ago. In September 2020, the EPA announced formation of its Office of Mountains, Deserts, and Plains to be in Lakewood, Colorado. The newest of the EPA's four offices having geographic focuses, this office was tasked with overseeing federal efforts to address the deleterious environmental effects of hard rock mining in the American West. Among its provisions, the Legacy Mine Cleanup Act would direct the Office of Mountains, Deserts, and Plains to coordinate with EPA's headquarters, the agency's regional offices, other federal agencies, and stakeholders any response actions at covered mine sites. The legislation defines a covered mine site as the land, water, and surrounding watersheds where extraction, beneficiation, or processing of hard rock ores or minerals occurred, but has been discontinued, including discontinued temporarily, according to the text of the bill. Any such interagency efforts to coordinate response actions would be required to give priority to covered mine sites for which there is no potentially responsible party, the bill states. Under S-3858, the EPA would be required to prepare annually a priority mine list of covered mine sites needing response actions. To be sent to various congressional committees, the list would describe the methodology used by the EPA to identify the sites, indicate the status of response actions pertaining to the sites. Promoting best practices. Another key purpose of the Office of Mountains, Deserts, and Plains would be to establish and disseminate best practices for covered mine site response actions, the bill notes. Such practices would include innovative technologies and reuse approaches that support and make progress toward those response actions and waste storage and disposal solutions, according to S-3858. Similarly, the office would be tasked with establishing best practices to protect and improve human health in the environment and implement appropriate reuse options, including through the use of innovative technologies to recover valuable resources from covered mine site features or areas as applicable, the bill states. More broadly, the EPA would be required to identify best practices for developing, reviewing, and approving site assessments, remedial investigations, and feasibility studies for covered mine sites, according to the legislation. S-3858 would also direct the EPA to develop a 10-year interagency plan to coordinate federal, state, and tribal efforts to address abandoned uranium mine sites within the Navajo Nation. Accelerating cleanups. On March 12th, the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, which Kelly and Loomis serve on, approved S-3858 by voice vote. On April 15th, the Senate passed the bill by voice vote. Taken together, the various provisions of S-3858 requiring greater coordination and focus on efforts to address hard rock mining contamination will go a long way toward improving environmental outcomes in the American West, Kelly said in a March 5th news release announcing the introduction of the legislation. Abandoned hard rock mines pose serious environmental and public health threats to Arizona communities and tribal nations, but the cleanup of these hazardous sites is too often delayed, Kelly said. By cutting red tape, creating greater accountability, and improving the coordination of local, state, and federal partners, our bill will accelerate the cleanup of abandoned mines. For her part, Loomis heralded the legislation as a means of facilitating more nuanced approaches to the intractable problems associated with hard rock mining contamination. In order to preserve Wyoming and the West's iconic landscapes, we need to abandon the federal government's one-size-fits-all approach and adopt region-specific solutions to preserve our Western way of life, Loomis said in the release. I'm proud to partner with Senator Kelly to codify the Trump administration's Office of Mountain, Deserts, and Plains to forge relationships with states, tribes, and localities to better support our unique ecosystems. The bipartisan bill has received support from the state of Arizona as well as certain conservation and environmental organizations. While mining is integral to the global economy, long-abandoned hard rock mines that predate modern regulations leave a legacy of environmental harm and public health and safety dangers, said Karen Peters, the CEO and director of the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, in the release. In Arizona alone, there are an estimated 100,000 abandoned mine features scarring the landscape. The Arizona Department of Environmental Quality has remediated many abandoned mines, but given the scope, it cannot solve the problem alone. This legislation broadens our ability to collaborate with federal agencies, industry, nonprofits, and others to protect the residents of Arizona and the environment from the impacts of these old mines. Other interested parties weighed in. Abandoned mines, some dating back to the 19th century, continue to drain toxic heavy metals into our waterways, and the existing laws make it extremely difficult to clean them up, said Becky Humphreys, CEO of the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, in the release. We applaud the introduction of the Legacy Mine Cleanup Act 2024, which would authorize the Office of Mountains, Deserts, and Plains at the Environmental Protection Agency to help clean up abandoned hard rock mines and improve water quality, benefiting both communities' water supplies as well as fish and wildlife populations. Added Chris Wood, President and CEO of Trout Unlimited, in the release. Abandoned hard rock mines are the largest source of water pollution in the western United States. The Legacy Mine Cleanup Act 2024 will facilitate cleanup of these mines and leverage the expertise and resources of state and federal agencies, tribal nations, and Good Samaritans such as Trout Unlimited. The bill also enjoys support within some politically conservative circles. For example, a representative of the right-leaning Heritage Foundation expressed approval for S-3858 in a March 11th news release issued by Lummis's office. Advancing the Office of Mountains, Deserts, and Plains is a step in the right direction whereby EPA is closer to the people they serve and are most impacted by their decisions, said Mandy Gunasekera, a visiting fellow for the Center of Energy, Climate, and Environment at the Heritage Foundation and the EPA's chief of staff during the Trump administration. I applaud Senator Loomis for her leadership in addressing legacy pollution in a responsible way. Next, from the source, projects, Northeastern U.S. rail infrastructure to be transformed, a piece by Celeste C.B. Bennett, dated April 2, 2024. The latest effort to improve the Northeast Corridor will follow a 15-year timeline and focus on service goals, travel trends, resource constraints, and workforce analysis. Even though the rail sector received a B in ASCE's 2021 report card for America's infrastructure, numerous repairs and upgrades are required to bring America's busiest passenger rail corridor to a state of good repair. Connect NEC 2037, the latest program from the Northeast Corridor Commission, aims to help make that happen to the benefit of the millions of people who rely on the NEC each year for commutes, appointments, and leisure activities. The aging corridor, which spans 457 miles from Boston to Washington, D.C., and comprises critical passenger and intercity rail routes along with freight routes, will get a major boost from C-37, as the program is known. The NEC Commission, created by Congress in 2008 and consisting of officials from Amtrak, State Departments of Transportation, and the U.S. Department of Transportation, works to secure funding and planning for the NEC and has developed and implemented numerous infrastructure projects to upgrade the corridor. The Commission website highlights the necessity of C-37. The NEC's most heavily trafficked bridges and tunnels are over a century old, and parts of its electrical and signal systems date back to the 1930s. These aging assets are prone to failure, disrupting service and creating delays for riders. According to ASCE's report card, infrastructure-related issues contribute significantly to NEC train delays. More than 300,000 train delay minutes in 2019, which equates roughly to 700 train trips from Boston to Washington. C-37 is being implemented on the back of another program, NEC 2035, which involved detailed assessments of rail lines, required infrastructure investments, and state of good repair goals, according to the November NEC news release regarding C-37. This enabled the Commission to prioritize initiatives and investments for C-37 projects to make them as efficient and thorough as possible. These projects will be integrated across 4 infrastructure owners and 9 passenger rail operators. While the Commission as a body doesn't set environmental goals for the NEC, the plan includes environmental benefits and outcomes based on the future service and planned investments. C-37 would need to be fully funded and implemented to realize the benefits, says Meg Persley, a public relations advisor for the NEC. Some of our member agencies set their own environmental and emissions goals, and those priorities factor into which projects are included in the plan. Private investment, public benefit. These benefits will be spearheaded by Amtrak, which largely owns the NEC rail line. The goals include environmental sustainability, user reliability, and long-term efficiency so that more Americans will use Amtrak services. Traveling on Amtrak releases up to 83% less greenhouse gas emissions than traveling by car. When you look at flying, we're about 72% less greenhouse gas emissions, says W. Kyle Anderson, a senior public relations advisor for Amtrak. So Amtrak is already the most sustainable option between Boston and Washington. So getting more riders riding Amtrak and intercity passenger rail rather than driving or flying has the most immediate benefit of taking out your higher carbon emission travel options. And as part of that, we've got plans to reach net zero emissions by 2045. Amtrak is also implementing a wider variety of carbon-free energy sources, including electric and renewable diesel fuel, and sourcing zero carbon sources for its electricity by 2030. Anderson says all Amtrak trains between D.C. and Boston are already electric, but planners are increasing sustainability through rail design as well. The company's new Acela trains are lighter and faster, requiring less electricity to propel them. They are made of lighter, slimmer materials, which will enable Amtrak to fit approximately 25% more people into these train cars. The commission says Amtrak's high-speed Acela trains will also reintroduce direct New York City-Philadelphia-Washington service, allowing riders to travel between New York and Washington in 2.5 hours. The upgrades and repairs Amtrak is conducting on its rail lines and trains will help meet the NEC's current and growing demand for reliable rail service, one of the Commission's major challenges. C-37 funding. Funding for C-37 will come extensively from the bipartisan infrastructure law passed by Congress and signed into law by President Joe Biden on November 15, 2021. According to the NEC news release, funding for C-37 will also come from the Federal Railroad Administration, $16.4 billion to 25 NEC projects through the Federal-State Partnership Program, the Federal Transit Administration's Capital Investment Grant Program, $6.8 billion, and annual funding approved by Congress, which will need to extend beyond the year 2026 to secure project completion. Anderson says that over the next 10 to 15 years, Amtrak II will contribute around $40 billion of infrastructure projects in planning and development, some of which have already begun construction. The $40 billion will go entirely to projects in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic regions, according to Anderson. The NEC says these coordinated strategies will improve the Northeast's core rail network and highlight the inherent challenges of planning, financing, and implementing major infrastructure improvements that cross multiple jurisdictions. This means less bureaucracy, more targeted infrastructure investment, and successful improvements to rail services that serve the Northeast. This has been Bill Nauman reading from Civil Engineering, the magazine of the American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE, and from Civil Engineering Source, ASCE's news and information website. Thanks for listening. Until next time, take care.